Hi, it's Lucy and welcome back to The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I put a spotlight on the talented women working in cinema, in front of and behind the camera. Today, I'm joined by someone whose work you've definitely seen, even if you didn't realise it. Louise Ford is a brilliant film editor whose career began in the world of journalism as the deputy editor at Cosmopolitan UK before she made the bold leap into film. Since then, she's become the go-to editor for director Robert Eggers, cutting haunting, atmospheric films like Nosferatu, The Northman and The Lighthouse. In this conversation, we talk about everything from how she made that transition to the creative process of editing such distinctive layered films and what it really means to shape a story in the edit suite.
Oh, there we go.
Hey, Lucy, how are you?
Hi, Louise. Nice to meet you. Where are you exactly?
I'm in New York. I'm from the northwest of England originally.
Okay, amazing. Okay. Yeah. Whereabouts in England?
A place called Cheshire. Well, Cheshire. A town called Nantwich, actually, which is really, it's like South Cheshire. It's about 4 miles from Crewe. I bet you've heard of Crewe.
Yes. Well, I used to study in Liverpool, so I remember Crewe.
Yeah.
I think Crewe was like on the line, on the train line to get
so
to like
my
Wales
little
or something.
Town is halfway between sort of Manchester and Liverpool, really.
Oh, wow. And now you're in New York. I mean, amazing. And you live there permanently now?
You're in France, so.
I mean, I think New York sounds cooler than France, to be honest. But
not at the moment. Not America. I don't know.
Yeah. To be fair, the politics what's the expression? Don't really have much to
recommend them. No.
Yeah, going for it. No.
We moved out here. My husband and I moved out here in 2001. I lived in London for about 10 years, I think, before that. I went to college in London and then I was a journalist for about 10 years before we moved out to America. He got a job over here and I retrained to be a film editor.
Well, we're going to get into all that because I'm going to ask you all about your you're starting before I've asked the questions. That's great. But yeah,
sorry if I'm doing this, by the way. I've got the wrong glasses on. They're like progressive. So if I might actually just take them off and you can just be a blur.
No worries. Whatever is, you know, most comfortable for you. I mean, I've got the worst quality camera other than this laptop and it's at night. Well, it's like dark outside now. So yeah, I'm not going to have nice natural daylight or anything. Your lighting is a lot better than mine. I mean, I've put on some lamps behind me, but anyway. I'm looking a little bit like I should be in Nosferatu myself.
Yeah, you are.
But thank you so much for agreeing to do this on a Sunday of all days. But I mean, I interviewed Linda Muir, the costume designer of Nosferatu, I think a week or so ago, and it was really interesting talking to her about the costumes. You're the first editor I've ever interviewed.
And
you're definitely the first. You're definitely the first. And yeah, it's a role that's always really interested me because for me, it's ultimately the editor kind of makes the film. Like you could change the trajectory of it, how it goes in terms of, you know, like a linear kind of way, how it's going to be interpreted ultimately. You know, if you think about films by, for example, Quentin Tarantino, you know, it's not necessarily in a chronological order, it's not linear. So yeah, the editing plays such a huge role in, you know, shaping
sometimes,
the film.
Sometimes. A lot of times those kind of fractured narratives it's in the script.
Yes, most of course. Yeah, that's
in the script.
It's explained.
But not always. But not always, you know, The Limey, very famously, the Steven Soderbergh film, The Limey, was a chronological film. And then it became in the edit, you know, flashback, told through flashback, that's an incredibly edited movie. I think that one of the most important things that people don't understand about editing is that how much it shapes the performance of the actors.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, people would not necessarily think that because the acting takes place during production, not during post-production. Mm-hmm. But only one part of the acting takes place during production.
Yeah. Well, I see what you mean. Yeah. Well, of course, if you're taking out certain scenes as well, or
just within one scene, I've got 10 takes of, you know, Lily Rose or whatever actor it is, and I choose what take I'm going to use, and it can either strengthen or weaken the performance overall. Obviously, I never want to weaken the performance.
Of course not. The aim is to make it the best as possible.
The sensibility of your editor in terms of their sensitivity to what's good acting, what's needed at a particular moment in the scene, what reads as authentic and organic, and I don't think you can learn that.
You've got to have an editing mind, haven't you, just to have that instinct that that's better than that and that's got to go. You've got to be quite maybe a bit ruthless as well in a little way, in some way.
Oh, you do have to be ruthless, but I don't, it's not about editing. That's not about editing. That's just about storytelling and understanding human psychology and understanding what reads as phony versus what as, you know, a real moment.
Well, since I like to do my podcast in a chronological way, I'm going to sort of more start at the beginning.
Oh, I thought we started. Sorry.
Oh, we have started. But I tend to like to start, you know, from your beginning, your education and early work experience. And, you know, when you were a teenager and a young adult growing up, you know, did you already have an interest in art and, you know, maybe from your parents or your kind of your surroundings to become an editor today, you know, sort of where did you start from?
Well, you know, there's not a straight line. I suppose it's the same with most people, although I don't really know. But, you know, I come from the northwest of England, a rural small town. There's no connection in any way to the worlds of, you know, film. There was a local, what do you call it, AMDRAM, Amateur Dramatic Society. My mom was an actress in that. She loved doing that. So I guess in sort of a very broad way, I guess that was my introduction to acting, I suppose, because I would go to the rehearsals when I was like 5 or 6 years old. In the 1970s, there wasn't really, and after school, I suppose, there was nowhere, I guess she didn't have a babysitter, so the AMDRAM rehearsals were my sort of babysat. But again, I did drama at school from the acting side of it, really enjoyed it. You know, I was talking to an editor friend of mine, Joy McMillan, who's the editor of, won an Oscar for her first film, Moonlight.
Wow.
She's an incredible editor. And we were discussing, you know, our childhoods and like what the, you know, what makes a good editor and blah, blah, blah. And we sort of came to the conclusion that we had both been those sort of quiet kids who spent a lot of time with their nose, you know, reading books, basically, reading fiction. And I think what happens when you're a kid that reads a lot of fiction, you sort of subliminally absorb the rules and tenets of what makes a good story and how the basic framework, I suppose, of good storytelling and what works and what doesn't work. And also inner motivations of characters, because of course in fiction you have the luxury of being inside the mind of a lot of your lead characters. You're following the psychology, the fact that when people talking to each other, they don't necessarily say exactly everything that's going through their mind. You know, there's an editing process there. So anyway, that's a whole other, you know, we can go down that wormhole. But to get back to your question about what I was like as a child, I suppose I was quiet. I was always interested in art and books. My mom would buy me a lot of art books. And when I say art books, I mean, you know, picture books, but she had good taste, you know, so I had like Brian Froud and, you know, Fairy Tales Illustrated by Arthur Rackham and, what's the other dude, Gormenghast, what's he called? Mervyn Peake, you know, that kind of stuff, which is relevant, which I'll come to later. This is actually weirdly relevant, but I was very, you know, as a kid, I was good, like I said, I was into reading, I was very good at English and literature, so I followed that path. And, you know, as a teenager, I was very focused as a teenager, having come from a background where, you know, working class background, it's about learning to do a job that you're going to be able to make money at, to be quite frank about it, you know. So the idea of, like, oh, being a writer or, you know, working in the film industry, you're being an actor, I mean, it's just not tenable.
Yeah.
Unless you come from, and even more so now than then, you have to come from a certain background because to do the arts, you know, to practice the arts, because unless your parents are paying for you to spend 4 or 5 years, you know, learning that, you're not going to be able to pay rent, frankly. So, sorry, went off on a bit of a working class rant there, but what I'm saying is the reason I pursued journalism, because it was a way I could use my facility with words and language to seem like a solid career path, like something I'd always be able to earn money in, you know. 35 years later, things have changed a little bit. Journalism has a completely, you know, is morphed into whatever. Let's not go down that path. But
maybe not as reliable as it was in the beginning, you know, in terms of career path.
Yeah. Especially in print journalism, which is what I was doing. But anyway, so I pursued that career path. But there was always a through line of being absolutely fascinated. And one of my favorite pastimes ever was always going to the theater and going to the cinema, you know, to watch drama. Even when I, you know, didn't have any money, I always seemed to be able to get to the theater, or get, you know, you get standby tickets, whatever. I've always loved, you know, Shakespeare, coming out of my literature, you know, literature background. And I mean, with film, I mean, interestingly enough, I did a year of an English degree at Manchester Polytechnic, and I dropped out because it wasn't career oriented enough for me. Mm-hmm. I wanted a journalism degree. But in that year that I dropped out, I did a film course, which is really weird because I didn't, you know, looking back on it, I did a film course and we did a little short film, and we edited stuff on a U-matic editing machine, which is like reel to reel tapes it's linear editing. So you know, in a similar way to when you're cutting film in the old days, it's that kind of editing. It's hard to go back and forth. You can't, once you've destroyed it, right? Unlike now in Avid, where you can have a million different versions and it's all there. But so yes, and then I spent 10 years being a journalist, and then I in London, and I got frustrated with that. I wasn't fulfilled. I wasn't enjoying it. I wanted to do something more creative. Mm-hmm. And my husband, Andy, he was an editor before I took it up. So he gave me the idea. You know, he was like, you should do this because you'd be really good at it. And I resisted for quite a long time because I'm like, I'm not just going to do what you want me to do.
Being stubborn.
I do. Yeah, just because I'm sort of frustrated with my current career. You know, you need to figure it out for yourself, don't you? So I spent a couple of years sort of trying to figure out what the hell it was I wanted to do. And eventually, just out of frustration more than anything else, I just thought, oh, sod it, I'll do an editing course then. I mean, it's film. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's more to it than that. We moved to New York. He got a job in America. We moved to New York. And I was suddenly meeting a lot of people in New York indie film world. Mm-hmm. And realizing that there was nothing, they didn't know any more than I did about films, or, you know, like, sure, people go to film school and all that. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just, they didn't have some magical knowledge because they went to film school. You know, like, I would be able to talk to them about the films of Nick Rogue, or, you know, whoever, David Lynch, or these filmmakers that are very important to me personally. And I'd realize that I knew more than some of them did.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, it doesn't have to be a film school path, you know. No, you learn a lot on your own.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of the personality where you just sort of think that to be legitimate or to be taken seriously, you do have to have some kind of... And anyway, whatever, I realised that, well, I'm as qualified as any of them to sort of do the work in this film world. So I did an editing course, a 6-week editing class, and as soon as I sat down at the keyboard and realised that I had all these things at my disposal, you know, they had the sound, music, can manipulate different takes. I mean, how the beautiful art that you get to look at, you know, especially with somebody like Jaron Blatchky, cinematography. You know, I have all of this at my beck and call, and I can get to play with it. You know, and I'm in the very privileged and luxurious position in a nice warm editing room while those are out in the freezing cold at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, true. You do get the sort of like the cushy end of it where it's just you can chill in a room and take your time.
I mean, obviously brilliant being on set as well. You know, I love visiting set when they're shooting because there's a buzz and an atmosphere and a camaraderie and a sort of in the trenches stuff about that, which is unique, you know.
The film course that you did, while you said that you were in a journalism course but you dropped out of that one, was that just like something that piqued your interest? You saw it and you thought, oh, a film course, I'm just going to give that a go, like an evening course type thing that you just...
It was more prosaic than that, or rather more practical than that. It's because what would this have been like in the late 80s? So from when I dropped out of my English degree in Manchester, in order to claim the dole, you know, unemployment, you had to keep them off your back by doing something.
Yes, yeah, the usual, or be applying for stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so I chose, it wasn't just that. I mean, obviously, I chose something that I was interested in at find it interesting pursuing. And actually, I'll be honest, I now remember it was a very small class. It was a great class. We were just filming stuff on using a video camera. And it was a small class, like I said, probably 12 people. And there was like three video cameras. Mm-hmm. And there were these enormous things, you know, like, but just crap quality. I mean, you see those videotapes from the 80s, you know, home video. Yeah, it's basically the quality that it was. But even then, I remember there was probably like, I can't even remember any other women in the class. I'm really struggling to remember now whether there's any other women. Out of 12, let's say there was 10 guys and 2 women. Let's just say mm-hmm. that for argument's sake. And I was one of them. And the camera came out. The lecturer brought the camera out. And the boys immediately swarmed around it wanting to know about how you work it. And I'm going back to the late 80s now, and I'm very hopeful that things have changed now for girls. When I was that age, 18 or something, I was instantly like, I can't do that because it's a technical. Ooh,
yeah.
I'm not
technical. I do get that around. No. I get the same way sometimes around certain technology like cameras,
right.
Computers. I do get a little bit. I don't know. I don't think it's a man woman thing. I think anyone can get that way, or an age thing as well sometimes, although I'm like of the millennial generation, so I've been brought up with smartphones and things like that, so I'm fine with that. But the same way I can get that way around cameras, where it's just like intimidating or a bit overwhelming, you know, to get your head around.
It's a man woman thing, let me tell you.
Is it? Okay, I'll take your word totally for it.
Totally is. Yeah, it is. You know.
I mean, yeah, I suppose if you go right back to what we get offered as toys when we're kids, if you go right back to the real dolls, babies, that's why I had like a baby Annabelle, Barbies, that kind of thing. I sometimes played with cars, but I wasn't playing with pretend tools and things like that, or, you know, or
just inescapable. It's social conditioning. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, when you're a kid, who fixes the car?
Dad,
right?
Yeah, usually, yes.
But why? You know what I mean? Why?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Why
is it that bizarre way?
But that's the way it is. But, you know, and that's the thing about editing, I think, and cameras. And that's why, you know, there's no women DPs.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
There's so few, I should say.
Yeah.
There's so
no, there few. Are there are a lot, but not. Yes, there's not as many.
But there's not as many women directors. There's not as women. You know, this is about, it is a, you know, social, it's just social conditioning. Mm. It's not about a matter of native ineptitude. You know, it's not a matter of like your natural aptitude for something. Mm. But it's not men's fault. It's just the way it fucking is, you know.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. Yeah, hopefully with the sort of STEM initiatives and stuff like that that are going on mm-hmm. now. But when I did that mm-hmm. film course there, yeah, and all the guys rushed to the cameras. And I have to say, honestly, part of me is because I'm not interested. I am not interested in how a camera works. I'm not interested in how an edit and how Avid works. I could care less. You know, all I care about is what does it let me do? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we've got a new version of Avid. Great. What can I do now that I couldn't do before? Mm-hmm. But I don't know why. Mm. I don't need that.
Yeah, like the ins and outs of it. Like, I don't tend to geek out for those sort of things, but I do get excited about like the final result or how things are going to look though. Or,
exactly. Yeah. And, you know, to me, it's more about the, you know, editing. I mean, I could think you could probably say the same. I'd be interested to know what Jaren thought of this, Blatchke, that most of my job happens in here. It doesn't happen, you know, it happens in my head. It happens, it's in your head. Mm. You know, pressing the buttons is 5%.
Okay. Mm.
95% is watching performance, thinking about the story, reading the script, being in that world. And I think I read an interview recently with an editor. I think it might have been Juliet Welfling. And she said, I edit with my heart. And that's it. You know, that's it in a nutshell. You can talk about methods, like what your daily, you know, procedures are when you're getting in the office in the morning. You do this first, then you do that first. And then all the tech, you can talk about the tech, you know, what version of Avid you're using and all that. And it's kind of, it's, you know, the job of editing is like, it's like writing. You know, I know that's a, you know, hoary old cliche that editing is like writing, but it kind of is. If you sit down to write, you know, where's the writing happening? Is it happening your pen in the paper? Is that where the writing's happening?
No, it's the pre-thought process. It's
exactly. That's just the tool.
Yeah. So.
I should have warned you about this, Lucy. I'm a bit of a rambler.
Maybe I am too. I am too. It's fine. It's just that there are questions that I want to ask you. So I'm not wanting to cut you off, but I do. There's certain things that I want to ask.
Cut me off. Otherwise, we'll be here for 4 hours.
So What were some of the first projects that you worked on, and how did they shape your approach to editing? Because you really started out on shorts, from what I've seen, before you went into features and then started collaborating with Robert Eggers, which I'll talk about, go on to a bit more later. But yeah.
Well, when I did that, I chose this editing class in New York at a place called the Edit Center, which I don't think is going anymore. But the reason I chose it was because you got to work on a live project. So it was 1 week of learning how the buttons worked. Mm-hmm. And then the next 5 weeks, you were left to work on a scene or two scenes from an indie film that was actually in the process of being still in post-production. Mm-hmm. And the director would come once a week to sit with you and, you know, go through the work and give you notes. So that's the thing that appealed to me about that. The other thing that appealed to me about that was that two or three nights a week, they would have an editor who had done the class, who was now working in the industry, would come back and screen something that they edited and then have a Q&A afterwards. And I, you know, that one of the advantages of being a little bit older, you know, most people in the class were sort of 18 to 20, and I was, having already done one career, I was in my early 30s. So I knew to seize the opportunity, basically, and I got everybody's contact details and emailed them all as soon as the class finished and asked if I could be, you know, if they needed an intern or work experience. And out of, you know, the 20 or 30 emails that I sent, couple of them came back to me, and one of them was an editor called Michael Taylor, who's an independent film editor in New York, and he needed a work experience on a job he was doing. So that was a HBO film, and I started off, you know, literally, you know, getting the coffee, but I was still over the moon. You know, I was amazed that I was able to sit in a room and watch Jeff Bridges do 10 takes.
Yeah, you know? Amazing.
I just be able to see that. It was amazing. You know, if you think like 3 or 4 months before, I'd been the deputy editor of Cosmopolitan magazine in London, having wow. interns getting, and now I was the intern getting the coffee, and I could not have been happier. You know, so
I was
going
to ask
more.
That though, because, you know, the idea of starting out a new career, what would you call it? I know what you call it in French. It's like they call it like a reconversion. You're sort of switching career paths, yeah. Basically.
Yeah.
Did that not feel like, oh God, I'm starting from the beginning again? I feel too old for this. Or, I mean, I'm approaching 30, so I know 30 is not actually that old, but in your head, you can make it feel like it is.
I think, I mean, I just sort of think like life's long-ish, you know.
Short and long at the same time.
Exactly. But do you want to do the same job for your entire life? I can't, I mean, maybe I don't know, maybe there's something wrong with me, but I can't imagine doing that.
I mean, you know, people do, but of course there's plenty that switch all the time and change, you know, they don't stay the same thing since they got out of school or uni.
Yeah. I mean, I would just think, you know, if you get that, if you start when you're 20 and you're doing a job that you love and you carry on loving it, of course, that's fantastic. You know, started doing a job which I really enjoyed to start with, and I loved the people I was working with were fantastic. They kept me in that job longer than I would ordinarily have stayed, actually, because it was such a great group of people who I'm still friends with today, and I still see them. But to a certain extent, I just got to the point where I couldn't take it anymore. I hated it. Mm-hmm. I hated that job so much that I didn't want to go to sleep at night, because that meant that the next day I'd have to go into work.
Mm. And then, you know, it's a problem that something happened.
Yeah, it was literally like a problem. I almost had no choice. I'd wake up in the morning and not want to get out of bed because it meant I have to get into work.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I was so stressed out because I was so not enjoying it. And then this amazing thing happened. I woke up one morning and I just thought, hang on a minute, it's just a job.
Yeah.
I can leave. I can resign.
Exactly.
Go do something else. And I think if you haven't got kids are, you know, another scenario. Mm-hmm. Makes it way more difficult, of course. I didn't have kids, and so I didn't have any encumbrances really to stop me doing whatever the hell I want to do, mm-hmm. whenever the hell I want to do it. And that's kind of how I live my life, and I've always lived my life. I've designed my life that way, which is, you know, part of the reason why I don't have kids. I cannot bear to be constrained by something like that.
Mm.
But I would say, if you are not, just do, you know, you live, you get one life, that's it. Don't wait. Mm. Do what you want to do.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, you woke up one day and you thought, actually, I don't have to do this. You know, no one's, you know, like the expression, like holding a gun to your head about it and being like, you have to be in this position. Like, if you want to change, you can. Although, and sometimes your head can make it feel like, oh no, but this and this and this. And what if I change, then this will happen.
I mean, obviously there's financial.
Yes, yeah.
There is financial.
You have to think it through.
You know, I was fortunate that I was with a partner who was happy to support me while I was retraining, you know, mm-hmm. in a sense, it's kind of like if you come from a rich family, I suppose you've got somebody supporting you while you do that training. But I like to think that I would have somehow managed anyway. I do, you know, I just find a way. Work, you know, I've worked in shops, I've worked in, I can do, you know, I'll always, I'm not scared of being out of work. I can always get a job.
Yeah.
I'll go do anything. You know what I mean? I'm not scared about that. And also I don't need a lot of money. I've having been without, you can get through it, you can get by.
Yeah, that's true. You do learn.
Maybe not in America, actually. Maybe not in America. In the UK, probably still can just about. But I mean, things is harder now than it. Now I'm talking about it. Let's not sugarcoat it. It's a lot harder to make these kind of decisions now than it was when I was doing it 25 years ago. So.
Did you have any, apart from some of the people that you've just mentioned, but did you have any mentors or filmmakers that influenced your own style and taught you lessons about editing early on? People that kind of gave you some, not necessarily guidance, but a teacher.
Yeah, Michael Taylor. Yeah, because when I went to that film as an intern, we got on really well. We had the same sort of sensibilities. We loved the same kind of movies. So he then took me on to be his assistant editor. And so I worked on a bunch of really low budget American indie films. The same time, you mentioned the short films, at the same time that I was working on those, assisting on those feature films, I was building up my experience cutting shorts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I cut a short called Priscilla for a director called Paula Eisel. She's now just in film school then. And she's become an award-winning documentary filmmaker and, you know, really brilliant filmmaker. So I cut a short for her. And then one of the shorts, during this time when I was an apprentice to Michael, one of the production runners sort of, we started talking and she said, I'm producing this short. Would you like to cut it? And I'm like, yes, I want to cut. Because as we mentioned, I was in my mid-30s when I started this career. So I knew that I don't have time to spend 15 years being an assistant editor. I wanted to get into that editor seat as soon as possible. So, and the only way to do that is to get experience cutting. So I was I was up for cutting anything. And she gave me the script and it was Robert Eggers, you know, it's a stroke of luck, huge stroke of luck.
Yeah.
Robert Eggers' adaptation of of The Telltale Heart for a short film. And the minute I read it, I was just absolutely convinced that it was apparent to me that Robert had a unique vision, is an incredible storyteller, and it was just unique, you know. Yeah. And that's what you hope for. That's what I went into this business, or this, you know, this is why I wanted to work in film, because the most influential filmmakers to me as an audience member, you know, David Lynch. When I saw Blue Velvet, I was a student in Manchester when I was studying English literature when I was 18. I think I was 18 when Blue Velvet came out, mm-hmm. and I saw it at the local art house cinema, the Corner House in Manchester, and it completely blew my mind. You know, I sort of remember sitting there watching the credits roll and just thinking like, oh wow.
What have I just watched? That has been, you know, a life-changing kind of moment up in there.
Yeah. No, seriously. I mean, I was just sort of like, oh, you can do that.
One of my first journeys into film, well, not really, but seeing that kind of film, basically, and sort of having that same realization that you said you had, was seeing Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. But I had no idea it was part of the series Twin Peaks. So I kind of spoiled it for myself by watching that film before the series. I was like, what is this? Oh, okay. And then I watched the series. But anyway, but I still remember watching it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's actually considered one of his best, but I remember watching it and thinking, wow, that was just like life-changing mentally, seeing that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Who cares what anybody else thinks? Yeah. It's seminal for you, you know, it's the thing that,
I was so sad that he passed. I mean.
Oh, God, don't. Yeah, 2025 can just take a running jump as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, not after a great start with him going, but.
Yeah, terrible. I haven't felt that sad since David Bowie, actually, about an artist, you know, going. But yeah, so they're the sort of. The filmmakers that, you know, as a kid growing up, I mean, I've spoken about this before, you know, I was the kid when everybody else went to bed, I'd stay up and watch those Hammer horror films, always sort of facing the kind of sensory overload type experience, I suppose. So I was watching those, and as a teenager, starting to see art house cinema, you know, it wasn't like my family had never took me to an art house cinema, they just wasn't a thing we did, you know. We went to see Grease and we went to see Star Wars.
Yeah, the blockbuster.
Which are great experiences.
Yeah, still good films.
I love that stuff too, but the things that really, like, turned me on were like Nick Rogue and David Lynch. And I don't know, I'm trying to think back to the kind of films that I was watching then. But anything that was sort of a bit extra, let's call it that. Yeah. Yeah. And so when I read the Telltale Heart script, I was like, this would have been 2007, I think. And to me, I'm like, he's one of those guys. He's going to be one of those
guys. Oh, he is, for sure. He's already, I think he's already there. I mean, like, with what he's, you know, what he's already got in his repertoire of films.
Yeah, but think back, this is before any, that was before any of that.
I mean, and yeah, I remember but you could already feel that and see that, you know, and tell that, but very much an auteur filmmaker with his own kind of, like, when you see a film by him, you know it's by him, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And that to me is the pinnacle. You know, Hollywood blockbusters, don't, you know, not interested. Mm. Seriously, not interested. I've never been interested in the mainstream as far as arts go. But anyway, getting off the topic. But when I met Rob, this is where the sort of the thing I was talking about, these children's illustrators come in. We kind of bonded over a love of like Arthur Rackham, who mm-hmm. was a Victorian children's illustrator. And the thing is, Rob's 15 years younger than me. So, I mean, and I'm obviously British. So I grew, he's a British, you know, he illustrator. So it's not that unusual that as a child I would have come across, you know, fairy tales illustrated by mm-hmm. him. For an American kid who's, you know, a lot younger than me, I was really impressed that he knew. And he, I know he's a massive Anglophile. He lives in London mm-hmm. now. He's moved there full time. But I'm pretty sure that he gave me the job, partly because I'm British and partly because, but we had the same kind of interest.
Well, yeah, if you,
you know,
find
the,
that kind of, that's what I was actually going to ask. I was going to say, you know, what do you think makes your creative partnership work so well? Because, you know, you've worked on The Witch, The Lighthouse, The Northman, and now Nosferatu. So clearly he has found a working collaboration that he likes, that works. And if the shoe fits, you know, like, don't change it kind of thing. So why do you think, you know, it's just worked so well? I mean, you've said that you found like a point in common there with his interest in these children's Victorian stories. So yeah, clearly. And it was the same with Linda. Like, he's worked with Linda Muir on all of his films pretty much. So yeah, I think when you find that partner or creative partnership that works, it's, you know, it's good to keep it, you know, to keep that relationship.
I mean, Robert is very loyal. And, you know, Jaren and I were on the Telltale Heart. So we were there from then. That was about 2008 by the time we made that, I think. And then when we got The Witch, when we started doing The Witch, that's when Craig Lathrop, the production designer, and Linda Muir Costumes came on board because they're Canadian. And actually Tracy Loader, who is the hair and makeup, who is also BAFTA nominated. She came on for The Witch. She's Canadian too. And yeah, then since then, you know, if it works, why break it? You know, it's always, you know, he's, Rob and I at this point are really good friends. And it's just that, yeah, it's just, I guess we just like the same stuff. You know, we just like the same stuff. It's that simple.
Yeah, I mean, of course, if you get on, that's so important. You don't want it to, like, of course it is very much, you know, you're working, but also at the same time you want to enjoy the work with your colleagues and it for it to be
it's a taste thing. It's like when you meet somebody who ends up becoming a really good friend. I mean, why are you friends? You know, why are you friends? I don't know, you just get on,
you just
feel a rapport. Yeah.
And of course, what could be otherwise, like, maybe quite an unstable, you know, career in the film industry. You know, you don't really know when your next project is, but if you've got a secure relationship there with a director or someone, you're kind of like guaranteed that their next film is going to include you. Are you not guaranteed?
I'm so lucky. I mean, I've hit the jackpot in terms of, you know, it's the sort of collaboration or relationship with a director that all editors
dream
want
of.
Yeah, you know, we all want to be Thelma, right?
Yeah. I was gonna say,
you know,
is she one of the ones that inspired you maybe in the beginning as well?
Sure. Though I tell you who really made me think about editing, though. When I was a kid and, you know, like I said, late at night, everybody else went to bed. And the things that used to be on TV in the 70s and 80s, you know, after 11 o'clock at night, they would just show a bunch of movies. And like, I watched, you know, Serpico and Bonnie and Clyde and Dog Day Afternoon. All these
that age, like watching those sort of films.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about when I was 13 or 14. Like when I was 6 or 7. So, but what I was going to say was, and so when I was older, I was sort of curious about why do these films really stay with me? I mean, those films really, still now, they're Dog Day Afternoon, if you haven't seen it, well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but it's an amazing movie. And honestly, you'll be surprised how modern it feels when you watch it. And also one of the storylines is incredibly of the moment. And I'm not talking about politics with a big P. I'm sort of skirting around because I don't want to say what it is, and I'm not going to say what it is. But it's about a bank robbery. It's about a bank robbery. It's based on a true story in 70s New York. And Al Pacino is the hapless bank robber, right? He's pretty crap at it. But it's a great, but it's brilliant, brilliant film. But the thing that I was like, why are these films in particular, out of all these films that you see on TV, well, they really, really stuck. They really made an impression. I felt emotionally engaged. I cared about the characters so much. And, you know, years later, out of curiosity, once I started getting into, you know, the films, thinking about the film side of it, because I have to say, even when I was a journalist in London, I was taking script writing classes with Robert McKee. You know, I was like, I was nibbling around the edges of maybe I could do it, even though
you're dabbling in it already.
It was a years long process of getting up the courage to actually fuck it, I'm going to do an edit class, right? It wasn't like an overnight thing. But anyway, so during this process of when I was like thinking about film and wondering whether I could do it, whether I could get into it, you know, IMDb, and I look at these movies, and guess what? It's not the same director. It's not the same actor. It's not the same cinematographer. It's not the only thing that is the same, that is the common denominator in all those amazing 70s films, is the editor. There's a woman called Dee Dee Allen, who's not around anymore, sadly. But she was my big inspiration when I started out, because she started off in sound. She's responsible for that incredible sequence in Bonnie and Clyde when they are, machine gunned to death at the end. The jump cutting of that sequence, that's all her. And she came from a sort of a mainstream Hollywood background, but she was so smart and innovative. She took what was going on in the French New Wave in terms of their editing, the way that they ripped up the rule book, and she took some of that and brought it into the Hollywood. I mean, there's so many, like, this is an everyday technique that I guarantee you every single feature film editor uses on all their films. I guarantee it. And that's a thing called audio pre-lap. When you're going from one scene to the next scene, you're going to hear like a second or two of sound from the scene that you're going into.
And it
makes the edit more invisible. She invented that. I mean, that is something that I use all the time. And, you know, the classic story about female film editors is that when film started out in Hollywood, all the editors were women, all of them, because the film guys regarded it as like, oh, it's just like knitting or something.
It's like an office sit-down job kind of thing.
It's a boring office job. Knitting, let's let the women do that, they'll do that. And then when they sort of realizing, hang on a minute, there is some like art and creativity going on, there is some, you know, talent that comes into play, so they muscled in, right? But still to this day, some of the best editors, the most well-known editors, the most iconic edits, the most iconic edit of all time as far as I'm concerned is Lawrence of Arabia, the match strike to the desert, Omar Sharif coming towards the camera in the very far distance, you know, and that's Anne V. Coates, a woman editor. That is an iconic edit, you know. Jaws, the feature film Jaws, you know, very well-known story. The mechanical shot was a complete disaster. It looked terrible. It wasn't working at all. Jesus, I'm blanking on I've got to find the name of that. I'm not going to not quote the woman's name. So hold on a second.
Of course, I'll let you think.
The editor of Jaws made the decision that the best way to cut that film was to not see the shark. She made the decision. Her name was Verna Fields.
Okay, and I didn't even know it was a female editor on Jaws. Well, I didn't even look into who the editor was of Jaws, to be honest. But
I mean, this is my specialist subject, right? Of course I would know this, but she made that decision, you know, in collaboration with Spielberg. Of course, we're all only as good as our directors are. Let me just say that. And I'm not trying to claim, you know, an outsized contribution here. You know, when I was talking about choosing performances, of course, that's in collaboration with the director. But, you know, when you get on really well, like when I have the kind of relationship with the director that I have with Robert, for example, I'll do a first assembly of the movie. And I would say probably 90% of those acting takes that I've chosen stay in. Mm. And the other 5% will be changed as we go through, and changed for good reason, because maybe, you know, the scene needs a take that is not, let's say, not so emotionally overwrought. Female film editors, yeah, I mean, Tarantino's film editor, who, again, I'm terrible. Well, she's not around. Sally Menke was Tarantino's editor. Unfortunately, she's not around anymore, so she didn't do the last few. But yeah, I mean, Thelma.
Yeah.
Surely she's the only film editor today who a layperson, let's call it that, might even have heard of. You know, I can't think. I'm not claiming. I mean, there's obviously a lot of brilliant male editors. Of course, there are.
But, I mean, if you hadn't told me about the other editor, Dee Dee Allen. I would have thought it was Thelma that invented the jump cut edits, you know, but she's obviously probably pulled it from her.
Oh, yeah.
From Dee Dee Allen.
Dee Dee's before that. Yeah, definitely.
Because I can think of a bunch of Martin Scorsese movies where that's used, and where she's used that quite frequently. And it really does make an impact on how the whole film is experienced overall, and how the scene as well.
I mean, I don't know enough. I don't think Dee Dee invented the jump cut. I think she took those ideas from the French New Wave films. Mm-hmm.
Of course.
But she made it a mainstream thing. Yeah, she made it her own
in a way. It
could be used in a regular film, if you want to call it that, a Hollywood film. You know,
just thinking about, like, I studied Breathless at uni, or A Buddha Suf, and that definitely had some very unusual jump cuts that when you first watch it, it's a bit jarring. You're like, what is going on? Yeah. But... Yeah. You know, it's like you said, they were sort of ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I've never warmed to that. I personally think that the French New Wave, I mean, I feel the same way about it as I do about Impressionism in painting, which is like, I don't like it, but I understand why. I personally don't like it, but I understand why it's so important in the development of where we're at now. You know, the idea that, you know, to me, Impressionist paintings, you know, the water lilies and all that stuff, it's like wallpaper.
Doesn't interest you.
It's like my boat. But the idea that you can paint something and just suggest a thing rather than be exactly 100%, you know, the sort of the abstract nature of it.
Yeah, of course.
Part of the development that you need, yeah.
What would you say your typical workflow is? Because you're very much part of the post-production process. You did say that sometimes you might, you know, go on set while sort of in production. But yeah, do you prefer to cut scenes as they're shot, or do you wait until you have like a larger picture of things? Or are you very much, you know, you get the script and then you think, okay, I'm going to start planning how this is going to be editing? Or is it just something that, yeah, like I said, it happens when as they're shot, or you wait till everything's done?
Well, of course, you get the script first. You know, it's a slightly different process with Robert, but if I'm just talking about general, like working with another director, what happens is the director will, you know, before I agree to obviously edit a movie, I have to read the script. So I'll read the script, and when I'm reading it, I'm thinking about how are we going to do that? You know, so when I have my interview with the director, then I can ask these questions. I remember one script I read, and there's like, it's a low budget, fairly low budget American indie movie. And there's a scene where there's a bear it's set during a forest fire, and there's a bear on fire halfway up a tree. And I'm like, how are you?
Is it going to happen?
You know, so I'm thinking about the editing. I'm also sort of trying to figure out whether it's going to be a good movie, whether they've got the budget, whether, you know, like, for example, that's an example of, you know, have you got the budget? What are you going to do? Is it going to be totally CGI? In which case I'm backing away from that, because I know it's going to be terrible, because you won't have the budget to do it properly. You know, a few years ago, this was. Eventually that scene didn't even make it into the movie, so that's fine. But I forgot what the question was. Sorry, I went off
so,
on a
rant. Yeah, the question was just,
what's my workflow like? Okay, so when they're shooting, you know, if I'm on a film and they're shooting, I'm getting, you know, the dailies. I have an assistant who organises them all into scene bins, what we call scene bins. So, you know, scene one, and then everything they've shot for scene one will be in that folder. Let's call it, like, it's more easily understandable term, in a folder in Avid. And I start cutting straight away. I'm not going to wait until, like, say, I use the wrong example there. Let's call it scene 26, all right? So I get scene 26 is what they shoot the first day of shooting. I'm going to cut that scene if I've got everything. Yeah. Some scenes that, you know, some scenes they shoot over 3 or 4 days, or some scenes they shoot part of it on day one of the shoot, and then the second part might not, you know, the other part of the scene might not be shot till the last day of the shoot.
Yeah, yeah. It's very rarely shot in order.
Yeah, consecutively. It is rare, but sometimes it's done that way. If the director particularly wants it in terms for the character, the way that he wants the actors to work, you know, with the character development, some very occasionally that would be definitely the exception.
Mm.
Because for budgetary reasons, you want the reason that you shoot out a sequence is, let's say I've got a film where there are four scenes and they take place in, I don't know, a ballroom, right? So you've hired that ballroom as the film production. You've hired that ballroom for 2 days to shoot those two scenes in. But so those four scenes which happen at different places in the movie, you have to shoot them all in those 2 days. Yeah. So that's why you shoot not in order.
Of course.
Primarily, it's, you know, financial. And sometimes it's the actor availability. You might only have an actor for 4 days, you know, to do their scenes.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, it's more about logistics than anything sometimes.
Yes, it's logistics. It's more logistics.
And when you're in the editing room, so, you know, Robert Eggers, is he obviously not there, you know, over your shoulder all the time, but, you know, I'm sure, I don't know, I can imagine some directors want a lot of control though, and they want to be like, no, don't do it like that. So how much do you have like freedom to just do it when they have faith and trust in you that you're doing it the way they want it to look?
Well, I mean, what happens usually is while they're shooting, let's just talk about Rob's, I mean, because it's kind of a similar process with other directors that I work with, but while they're shooting, he's shooting 5 days a week, and then I'm editing the scenes together 5 days a week, and then maybe on the Saturday or the Sunday that weekend, he'll come in, while they're shooting, this is, he'll come in and I'll show him what I've done so far. He might want to look at some particular, even stuff that I haven't edited, he might want to look at takes for a particular scene just to check that he's happy with what they got. So we'll spend a couple of hours, maybe on a one weekend day doing that. But while he's shooting, that's the most sort of involvement. Unless something comes up, like an urgent thing comes up, and he's like, okay, which occasionally happens, he might want to phone in and say, Luke, can you just tell me, did we get this close up or do we need to shoot again? You know, we're worried about the eye line in this particular shot. So things, and occasionally things like that will happen, but that's occasional, because with Rob and Jack, Rob's films are so well planned out. Once the shooting's finished, as an editor in feature films, I get 2 weeks to put together what's called the assembly. So the last day of shooting, by which time, you know, by the last day of shooting, I should really have, the idea is to try and keep up with what they're shooting, right? So in theory, I should, you know, after the end of finished shooting, I should be able to finish putting it together in the next 3 or 4 days, you know. But, you know, in practice, that never happens. You get delayed, things get put back. There might be a camera issue, which has to be sorted out. So I have to spend days going to, which happened on this project now, I have to go to a DI theatre to look at the footage to make sure it's not, you know, out of focus, and then report back to the director. So I'm losing my editing time doing stuff like that. Okay, that occasionally happens. For whatever reason, 2 weeks, I have 2 weeks when they finish shooting to finish cutting the entire movie, which is why it's important to try and keep up with, you know, to edit the scenes that they're shooting while they're shooting it. There's, you know, you can't.
Otherwise you'll be behind.
Yeah, you can't cut an entire movie in 2 weeks. So you have to be.
Yeah, especially when it's, well, I mean, I know Nosferatu wasn't, I think it was two hours.
Yeah, but you have to, you know, you want to be like 3/4 done by the time they finish shooting. So then you've got you know, a couple of weeks, finish cutting the scenes, have time to watch it down and then make sort of small adjustments, do your own set of notes before you then present it to the director. And then that's called the, you know, the assembly. And then what happens after that is then you have 10 weeks with the director to work on what's called the director's cut, which is what you then show to the studio or the producers.
I noticed that in certain DVDs or films it says the director's cut, so yeah, that's interesting to know what that actually means.
And a lot of times it's longer or whatever, you know. So in during those weeks, it depends on the director really how they want to do it. With Rob, he comes in every day, we work 9 till 6.
It's a long day in front of the computer, I mean, editing solidly.
I mean, yeah, but you have a
break
time.
Obviously, or you go insane. You get a break.
He And the way Rob does it is he's not sort of looking over my shoulder the whole time. He'll have a desk set up in the edit room and he'll be working on the next thing. Like, he's generally reading and researching and writing the next script, or not necessarily the next script, another script. He generally has a room in whatever edit facility we're working in. He'll have a room separate from our room, which is just a library where he brings all his books for research. That's been the way it's been for the last couple of films. And so I'm working away doing notes. He's sitting behind me working on his thing. And then I'll sort of say, hey, Rob, let's watch this bit. And then I'll play a bit. We'll watch it. We'll discuss it. He'll give me notes, work on it. Sometimes it will be more intensive. Like, there'll be a scene that we really need to spend time on together. For example, there was a scene in Nosferatu with Lily Rose Depp and Anna. They're walking along the beach. You know, that it's not a beach, it's an estuary. They take the kids to the estuary for the day, and Lily has a very long sort of a bit of dialogue there, which was quite difficult. It's probably the most difficult dialogue scene for her in the film, because it's sort of very hard to sort of pin down exactly what the mood or the emotion is at any particular time. It's very, for whatever reason, it was a tough one. So Rob and I spent at least a day replacing, listening. This is something that happens in editing as well, is, you know, we have our picture take. So maybe there was 10 takes. I think there was more than 20 takes of this.
Wow.
Because she kept trying to get the performance that she wanted and that Rob wanted. So there's more than 20 takes. So we choose the picture take that we like the best. And then it's a process of going through line by line with the dialogue, and sometimes word by word, listening to every single audio take and choosing the line, the delivery that we like the best.
Okay.
So that particular scene, you know, and that's another part of editing that people don't understand, that you're not only choosing the visual performance, you're choosing the dialogue performance
and the
too.
Sound as well. Yeah, the dialogue, the sound, everything.
Exactly. But, and also the sound, the dialogue that you hear was not necessarily the dialogue that the actor was saying in that particular take. You know, I might take the line, the first line of dialogue from take 5, and the pitch is take 22, and then the next line of dialogue might be from take 7. And the next line of dialogue might be from take 13. You know, it's literally
kind of like a big puzzle maze sort of that you're.
Yeah, and it's not as that makes it sound sort of quite simple, but it's not simple, because of course you can say the same line 10 times, and your voice is gonna change. I mean, when I'm talking to you, my voice is going up and down. The emphasis might be on a different word, so it's quite there's a skill to understanding, to being able to listen to the rhythm of the way people talk and where they put the
emphasis. Yeah, it's subtle maybe to most people's ears, but you know, you've got to have that certain ear as an editor as well, I can imagine, to be like, well, does that flow emotionally with the rest of the scene and the way she's speaking, for example?
And also where you want the emphasis to be on a line. I think there's a line at the end of that scene, actually, where Anna says, I'm trying to remember the line now, your heart.
If you can't remember, I probably won't be able to remember either, but
true heart. I think she says something about your true heart, you know, and you every take she says something, da 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 da, your true heart, da 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 da, your true heart, da 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 da, your true heart. This is not the line, but I'm just giving an example. But what we wanted was your true heart, which has a slightly different effect, right? So it's stuff like that. That's an example that editors do all the time.
I mean, Nosferatu is such an iconic film in horror history, really. Did you have a specific approach to editing this new version when you kind of wanted to honour the legacy of, you know, the previous Nosferatus that have come before?
Yeah, well, obviously it's kind of an intimidating undertaking to, you know, and I know Rob obviously feels this, to presume to make another version of it when there's already two astonishingly brilliant film versions of the story already. But I think that because Rob felt that he could bring something else to it, bring forward the more sort of hidden parts of the story. For example, you know, the fact that Ellen, of course, is the obvious thing, that Ellen is the main protagonist in this version, you know, and traditional storytelling, you know, Hutter is the hero that goes up, you know, and the fearless vampire hunters, sort of the idea of Van Helsing and was it Von Franz in our film, but you know, in the Dracula stories, Van Helsing, Von Franz, vampire killer, the gang of guys that get together and stake the vampire at the end, and that, you know, it's that Nosferatu isn't that story actually, that he took the Dracula story and changed it slightly. So Bob has sort of taken Murnau's interpretation of it, with Ellen being the center of the story, but he's actually, Rob's taking it one step further, where she's actually the protagonist and in more of the film than she was in the original Nosferatu. From an editing point of view, you know, it's like I didn't consciously go into this having thought about the editing techniques that were used in Murnau's 1923 version, or Herzog's 1979.
Yeah, you're very much like, this is a new version, a new project, you know, it's, even though it's got relations to the previous stories, it's very much his own version, it's a new one.
I mean, there is one scene in the 1920s. I hadn't thought about this consciously until I was talking to, I did an interview with an editor called Dylan Tickner, who's an incredible editor. He does Paul Thomas Anderson movies. He's one of my favourite editors in terms of, you know, who I would want to emulate. But he reminded me that there is a scene in the original Nosferatu where Hutter is in the castle and he looks down the corridor and Nosferatu is like miles away down the corridor. Mm. And then you cut back to Hutter's face close up being all scared. And then you cut back to his POV and all of a sudden, Orlok's in the doorway, you know, right? So that's an interesting editing technique. And I, you know, because it's scary, it's shocking. It's sort of like 1 minute he's there, next minute he's here. You know, it's obviously the idea of Orlok being able to, you know, magically move from one part of the room to another, as he does in our film, you know, in the Great Hall at the beginning. 1 minute he's looking at the document at one end of the table, next minute he's pouring wine.
Yeah, so it's
that idea. But I think that weirdly that editing technique must have subconsciously got into my head, because it's kind of mirrored in the crossroads sequence where the horse and carriage are coming towards him, and you know, you see them slowly coming towards him, cut back to Hutter, cut back to the horse and carriage coming towards him, and then next minute they're rearing up and they're right in front of him.
Yeah.
So partly it was the way it was shot, I have to say, but that cutting pattern, I suppose, went in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't conscious. I just feel like you can't, I don't know, I don't actually want to bring anything from another movie, even if thinking about it. You sort of have movies where you spot an editing technique or something that the editor's done, of course, where I'm thinking, wow, that's amazing, I'll store that one away for some point in the future.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not as...
Maybe subconsciously, though, it's there when you're editing, though.
Well, and conscious, but I mean, consciously, you know, if there was... that I might think, it depends, but it all depends on what I'm seeing in front of me in the film that I'm working on right now. So if this material I'm getting is... I'm feeling like it's asking for that kind of, maybe an editing technique that I've seen in another movie, you know, then I'll use it. You know, in Luca Guadagnino's film, A Bigger Splash, with Ralph Fiennes and Tilda Swinton. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing movie.
I've seen this one, yeah.
Incredible. Well, there's some amazing, you know, some of the music in that. And I don't just mean the records that Rafe plays, but there's some score pieces in there that I actually used in another movie, in Thoroughbreds, which is a film with Corey Finley, the director. I took inspiration from that music. I used that music. There's a very sort of avant-garde sort of string, like shot sort of, I don't know how you describe it really. It's like a stabbing string at a certain point. And I used that in Thoroughbreds in a particular scene. So there's those kind of things. They store away. And I think when it's the right movie, maybe I can use a bit of that, but they suggest themselves to you when you're watching the film that you're working on now. But in terms of Nosferatu, I did not go in consciously thinking about any editing techniques that Murnau or Herzog employed in their versions of the story. I just went in just as usual, relying on my own instincts and my own sensibilities to take the dailies that, you know, the beautiful dailies that I'm being given and the amazing acting performances, and just let them tell me how to, you know, what takes to use it. Just it. And with Rob and Jaren, they're so planned out, you know, the blocking and the camera, the blocking of the camera, you know, is paramount. The actors, unusually in feature films, because it's usually the other way around, where the camera responds to what the actors want to do. But in Rob's films, the actors have to work around the camera. The camera movies worked out first with the blocking. They have to sort of conform to what the plan is for that.
I mean, you said there, so you're not necessarily taking, like, consciously taking inspiration from those people from the previous films, but did you use editing for Nosferatu in a certain way to build that tension and fear in the film? Was there certain techniques that you used in particular that you can think of?
It's a lot of it is sound. I mean, the way that, you know, like I said, they have Rob and Jared. They're thinking about tension. Of course they are when they're blocking out and figuring out their shot list. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have very long takes. And, you know, when Hutter first gets to the castle, from the crossroads to the castle doors opening, and the first time we see Orlok, he's appearing in the very sort of far background as a tiny little figure through the opening castle gate. That sequence, the way that you build tension in that really is it's sound. And I used a lot of, we talked about David Lynch earlier, but David Lynch's sound designer was a guy called Alan Splett, who was a genius. He recorded analog recordings of a lot of industrial machinery in factories at night when there wasn't any other sounds around, just the humming of the machinery. So when you think of a David Lynch film and you think about those, there's always that weird sort of humming, droning thing going on in the background.
Definitely in Eraserhead, for
example.
Yes,
exactly. So that's Alan Splett. And I've got a sound designer friend of mine, very kindly passed on his Alan Splett sound library to me. And I use that, and there's hundreds of tones and weird sort of background drones and tones. And I, you know, they have things like, there's the library that's called Liminal Void, which contains about 80 different tracks. And there's one called Sounds from Another Realm, which again contains about, you know, 100 different tracks. Yeah, and they're all different tones. You know, you've got a high tone, a low tone, a mid tone. And I sort of, I use those to orchestrate. I orchestrate those long sequences. So there's a certain tone, you know, when the gate opens. And then, like, as soon as Orlok appears in the background, do it as well. They come together. It's brilliant. I love doing that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely, the sound is another part that stood out to me so much when Nosferatu as well. And the voice of Orlok, which was just, like, ringing in my head when I left the cinema.
That's Bill. I mean, just a note on the sound. I'm talking about in the edit room when I'm trying to pitch edit. I need that to help me feel the pacing of when you want to go from one shot to another. But of course, that gets stripped out by Damien Volpe, our genius sound designer, who makes it, you know, a million times better, of course, takes my sort of sketch and elaborates on it. But Bill's voice, Orlok's voice, is Bill. You know, I'm sure you've read all the press interviews where he trained with an opera singer to lower his voice a pitch. But it's not just and he had to deal with this bizarre sort of accent, like Hungarian 15th century accent, and he's speaking a dead language sometimes called Dacian, which was a language of the Austro-Hungarian sort of geographical area for a brief time, and it's extinct now. So Rob collaborated with some linguistic scholars who managed to cobble together a version of what the best guess about what some of those words would be. But really, and Bill's, it's the breathing, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Almost felt like he was right there beside you, breathing down your neck.
And that's not all. That was not post. That was, in other words, that was not recorded later after they'd finished shooting. He was doing that while they were shooting. So I had, and I don't know how his throat wasn't wrecked, you know.
I know. Needed all those throat sweets at the end of the day after all that.
He sounds like he's, you know, 60 cigarettes and drunk a bottle of whiskey before every shoot. I really hope he didn't do that. But
deliberately gave himself a sore throat to sound better.
Yeah, that death rattle kind of sound is in the script. Again, it's in the script. It all starts with the script. It's in there. The fact that every breath is laboured, every breath sounds like, you know, imagine these sort of ragged lungs that are half, I don't know, rotted away. It was horrible. But that was really useful for in the editing, because again, editing is rhythm. And obviously the rhythm of a breath, you know, Orlok's breathing. I mean, this isn't just for Orlok, this is for any time I'm editing any character though, but I use the breath a lot to help time out, you know, my picture cuts a lot.
Interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if I can, like, if there's any sort of iconic editing that stands out to me from certain films, just in general, not particularly the ones you've worked on, but certain transitions. I love when maybe they use the sound, just for example, I can't think of a film, but imagine there's like a clock ticking and then they manage to make it fit into the next scene with the sound of someone tapping their foot on the floor or something like that kind of thing.
It's like an audio natural. Well, actually, we did that in... Well, The Telltale Heart, of course, is a story that's crying out for that, because at the end of that story, he's buried his... the servant has buried his master under the floorboards, and the police come round, and the police are interviewing him about where his master is. And because he's so racked psychologically with the guilt about it, he starts hearing the heartbeat underneath the floorboards. And so time that, you know, timing that with the tick of a clock is very helpful. But well, in fact, in Nosferatu, there are, when Hutter gets into the carriage and he's going across the bridge into the castle, there's the hoof, there's the sounds of the horse's hooves, and there's a heartbeat. And it, actually, that was a really tough in the sound mix. That was very tough to modulate to get it into, so it was all in time.
Like syncing up, basically. Is that what you call it, syncing?
Yeah, or that you could hear everything. Sometimes maybe being out of sync, just so you could hear everything, but then when you throw it out of sync, whatever. It's a very complex, in Nosferatu, a lot of the times we were spent a lot of time mixing the sound and the music, you know, because the music is obviously hugely important as well. But we sort of like some. You'd let the sound design take over and the music would come down, and some scenes you let the sound design come down and the music come up. So it's a question of orchestrating.
Were there any films that you like studied or reference to while you're editing Nosferatu or before, like to sort of get some inspiration or an idea of what you're going for?
I mean, always sends with any film that he does a whole big list of.
I think Linda Muir said that as well, actually.
Yeah. And they're always really obscure. You try and watch as much of them as you can.
Yeah.
I don't have as much patience as Rob does, despite, you know, my natural predilection being towards art housey stuff, or stuff that's different, at least. I'd have less patience with stuff that I feel is, that's, I sense is a bit pretentious, you know? Like, you can have art house, and it doesn't have to be pretentious, you know. Like The Substance is a brilliant example of that, for my money. You know, it's just a great, enjoyable romp.
I haven't seen The Substance yet. I'm going to psych myself up for it.
It doesn't. There's no sort of. There's no feeling of like intellectual pomposity or anything. It's all you know, it's brilliant. But anyway, I forgot what the question was again.
Did you watch any? Yeah, the list of films that Robert sent you. Although from what you said, he sounds like he lives and breathes it. Like, you know, even when he's in the editing room with you, he's reading and writing for other films. So like he's
the next
like
thing. Yes, the next thing. And honestly, for me, while I'm in the throes of editing a movie, I kind of don't want to be watching other stuff. You know, when I'm editing a Robert Eggers movie, for example, I don't necessarily go home and watch Criterion Channel movies or whatever. Well, I'll go home and watch some, you know, Slow Horses on Apple, or, you know, TV series.
Something to deconnect, some reality TV.
Yeah, I have to switch off, because I'm not actually, if you don't switch off, you haven't got, I don't think it's necessarily good for the movie. You know, you have to sort of be able to relax, so that when you get into the edit room the next day, you're fresh.
Yeah.
Whereas if I've gone home and watched a bunch of movies that are on Rob's list, I'm still in it. I'm still like in work.
Yeah, you haven't really stopped working. You know, you're still in working mode.
So I actually actively do the opposite of that. But, you know, a lot of the films, I've seen them anyway, because, you know, Possession, you know, because the obvious one with Isabella Gianni. Obviously, that was a massive touchstone for Lily's performance in the, you know, in her scenes of Possession. In fact, I think I went to see that with Rob years ago when it played a local the Film Forum here in New York, which is a great repertoire in New York. You know, Polish film from the 80s with Sam Neill as well. Is it Zulawski? I think it's Zulawski. Yeah, so I was kind of, you know, getting back to the idea that we're into the same things. A lot of times I've seen all the seen a bunch of the movies that Rob, I know where he's coming from because I just know him so well. I mean, we've been friends for nearly 20 years at this point.
Wow. So yeah, quite a long time then. I mean,
Yeah, so kind of a lot of going to, not so much lately because he's moved to London, but you know, we would go to see movies and stuff, discuss things even when we're not working together. So,
what do you think separates a good editor from a great one?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's, you can be a good technical. I mean, this is, I think it's the same with B. If you ask the question, what separates a good director from a great one? What distinguishes a good DP from a great one? It's about knowing who you are and knowing what you are into and being true to yourself. I'm sorry, that sounds so trite. That sounds trite, but I think that's okay. What it is.
It's a good answer.
It's knowing what you're in, it's knowing your thing and just following that, on being honest, you know, with your, the way that you enact your skill, your art, whatever, you know. I think that a great editor infuses their own sensibility into the work that they do. I mean, what makes Dee Dee Allen, you know, an incredible editor is because she understands people. She understands, you know, what makes somebody a great writer is you understand how people work, the psychology and of how people work. So, you know, when you watch a film, if something stays with you, it's usually because something in the writing or the performance really strikes a chord, you know, or makes you think about something in a different way. And so a good editor is somebody that knows which take to use, right? That, maybe that's it. I don't know.
There you go.
I don't know.
Yeah, they just have that maybe intuition or instinct where they just know what's right and what's wrong and what doesn't work and what works.
I think instinct is a good way of putting it. It's just that your instinct is attuned to the human sensibility.
And you also know how to, you know, translate emotion and psychology through art, you know, whether that's writing or editing or film.
Yeah. Well, all art is about connection, isn't it? Of course. When you walk around an art gallery and get a painting or a bunch of paintings and you stop in front of one that particularly stops you in your tracks, it's because you feel a connection somehow, whatever it is, whether it's the colour or the shape or the scene that's being depicted, something about it resonates with you personally. So I guess a great editor is somebody that understands that, how things resonate.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the editing, whether it's like you said, Dee Dee Allen doing her jump cuts, she had an understanding that, well, just doing a standard, very simple standard cut wasn't going to, you know, provoke the same emotions as, you know, doing jump cuts. She knew that, you know.
Exactly. It makes it all the more shocking, that particular Bonnie and Clyde, you know, it really.
And what advice would you give to young women aspiring to become film editors like yourself?
I mean, advice particularly for female film editors, I think.
Not just that, editors in general, I mean, not necessarily female.
I would say just pursue that which interests you. Pursue the, whatever the genre is, or if it is a genre or a particular type of director or a particular type of story, you have to find your own voice. I mean, it's kind of what we were just saying about what makes a great editor versus a good editor. It's finding your own voice and knowing what that is. What are you into? You know, don't like work on a contemporary drama if what you're really into is period horror films. Let's just say that, you know. Or I mean, maybe it's not even, I mean, genre is such a blunt way of sort of describing the different sort of things. Or don't, you know, if you're into sports, go work in sports TV, you know, why pursue a career in fictional storytelling? If you're into documentary, pursue that, you know. Don't get weighed. That I would say a really big piece of advice, and something that was, that I was fortunate that I was older and this was a second career, because in a way I didn't have time to get sidetracked sort of working in, like, at a certain point in my career, you know, when I was an assistant, I could have gone to be an assistant on a TV show and then you get down that path, right? But I knew, I was very single-minded from the beginning. I want to edit feature films. I want to edit scripted feature films. So I only went down that path. So I think, you know, again, it's like knowing what you want to do and being bloody minded about pursuing that one thing and not getting knocked off course, because it kind of, what happened in my first career was, you know, I started off being a journalist wanting to be right society's wrongs, you know, be a war correspondent or something like that. And I ended up working at Cosmopolitan magazine.
Slightly different, but still, I mean, a rewarding career.
Yes, nothing against Cosmopolitan magazine. It's just that, you know, that, if you go down a certain path, that's where you'll end up, you know, at the end of that path. Yeah, but just follow what you know, whatever your burning passion is, whatever the type of movie or the type of director that really it makes you enthusiastic about wanting to do this, pursue that, and pursue those sort of more general interests. You know, if you're into art house cinema, join the local art house cinema and go and see as many art house cinema films as you possibly can. If you're into, you know, David Lynch, go and see at the cinema all his films, find the films that influenced him, you know.
Yeah, I think it's also about filling your life up as much with all those things you like as possible, you know, because and getting rid of the stuff that you don't want to be doing.
In a weird way, it shouldn't be an effort. It's not an effort to be, you know, to just, when you're really into something, you naturally pursue
Yeah, you'll
it, you
naturally
know.
sort of drift towards it or attract.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, if you do that, then you're gonna, when you meet a director like when I met Robert, you know, because I was already into the kind of stuff that he was into. It, you know, it's kismet. You get on and you meet and you end up working together. But you know, very lucky, of course. But you know, the more that you pursue your interests, the more people you're gonna meet who are interested in that stuff too.
Yeah, it's like the law of attraction, like you gravitate towards it, I think, that kind of
Exactly.
thing. And looking ahead, what kind of stories or filmmakers would you love to work with in the future?
I mean, I'd love to work with, of course, you know, Lynn Ramsey, Luca Guadagnino, Jonathan Glazer, of course, Lanthimos, you know, you know, Ruben Ostlund. They've all got their editors already, you know, that's the way it usually works. But those kind of filmmakers, that's who I want you mostly to work with. I'm a bit worried at this moment in my career, I have to be honest, that I'm getting typecast in the horror thing, which I definitely do not want to do. Horror is, there's amazing horror movies, there's amazing all kinds of movies, but I don't want to go down that one road. I'm just open to anything that's different and original
Yeah,
and
I mean, speak it
moving
into
away from
existence. Do you know what I mean? So, who
that.
knows?
Yeah, put that into the universe. Ruben,
Yeah.
call
If he listens to this podcast, be like, Ruben, please call. And do you see any emerging trends in editing that you are excited about and that you think will start to shape the
Well,
future
I
of
can see
film?
an emerging trend that I'm not excited about and I'm worried is going to shape the future of film,
Oh,
and
I
that's
think I know what you're about to say.
AI. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm fortunately for feature film editors, or really, I suppose, any, not just feature film, any sort of
TV or
content. I hate using that word content. Blech,
yeah.
wash my mouth out. And I mean, or documentary or feature or scripted. The one thing that AI cannot do and will never be able to do is human emotion, right? So hopefully we're
That's
okay.
true. That's true.
Hopefully we're, until they learn to ape it. But I mean, it's funny in this whole conversation, like the filmmaking industry has been through such an upheaval over the last 4 years with COVID and then various, you know, labor disputes, the strike, and then the contraction of the streaming industry. A lot of people, the last year has been really, really tough for a lot of people. I'm very lucky to be working. But I think what's funny is that there's all this talk about AI taking over, you know, acting or writing, you know, which to me are like the two things that it can't do. But you know what it could do? It could be brilliant at taking over being a studio executive. But it's funny how that's being talked about.
I mean, there's a lot of jobs it probably could do, yeah. I know what you mean. I mean, a lot of people are quite scared about the whole AI thing, and yeah, you can see just like everything, you can see the sort of positive side to it and what it could do, and then the other side, it's like you said, it can never replace human emotion, proper acting.
You know, actually think about it. When you watch a movie, you know, there's a lot of CGI. Obviously, there's a lot of CGI now, but especially to me in the field of like stunt work, for example, when you're watching those Marvel movies and it's literally all CGI, you know, all these characters fighting each other and you know none of it's real. I mean, you're not invested, are you? You're not emotionally invested. You don't really give a shit. You know it's all going to be all right in the end or whatever, or the baddies will die, or maybe a couple of the goodies will die, but it, you know, whatever the way, you don't feel that visceral fear when you're watching these fights. But you think about that old black and white piece of film of Buster Keaton, I think it's Buster Keaton, standing in a doorway and the whole wall falls down and he's standing in the doorway. This isn't a set, you know, it's a wall. It's like the facade of a building, and he's standing in front of it, and the whole building falls down.
Okay.
But that's real. But that's for real. Like that is a piece of building that fell down around the actor, and the actor was really sad there. It's the 1920s. Wow. There was no computer generated. You watch that and you feel fear for him.
Yeah, I mean, definitely when I watch Tom Cruise doing some of his stunts, I'm like, that don't know how he's doing that.
Exactly. But you know, and that's why he does them. That's why he does.
Oh yeah. He wants to create the real emotions. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, he just doesn't, yeah, he doesn't want to fake it really, does he?
So AI can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't replace that.
You can't do hands. So I think we're
can't
all right
do what, sorry?
Can't do hands. You know, famously AI pictures. If you can tell an AI picture because the hands are always a bit weird. You were asking me whether there was an editing technique that I was excited about or a new thing I was excited about. Yeah, I guess I answered it. I'm not excited. No, nothing, there isn't actually at the moment. There isn't.
Okay. But maybe to be continued. We'll see. Maybe there will be something. And lastly, to finish, what are your top five favourite films for their editing?
Wow. Yeah, I'm on the spot now, aren't I? I really love Nick Rogue's Bad Timing. There's some incredible editing going on in that. There's editing. I mean, I imagine that was from the script stage too, but it's about a relationship that goes wrong between a man and a woman. And there's a scene where they meet up years later and they have a conversation on the street, just a very casual conversation, but you hear what they're going to say before they say it. And it's amazing. As well as plenty of other strange editing stuff. I mean, Nick Rogue's films are like an editing masterclass, really. They're incredible. Mm. Recently, I was really blown away by La Chimera. That stood out. I thought some of the editing techniques in that were incredible. I need to name check that editor because I've mentioned this film before, and it's Nelly Kettier. I mean, God, she'd be my editing hero right now. She works with Claire Denis. She did Annette, which was the, that wasn't that, that was Leo's character. Yeah, his musical. So she cuts his films. She cuts, what else is it? Holy Motors, and she's incredible.
She's worked on some pretty good films.
Yeah, it's basically Claire Denis and Leos Carax, Trouble Every Day, Javai, and what other edited films, well-edited films? I mean, Phantom Thread is a big one for me. That's Dylan Tickner, Paul Thomas Anderson, for my money, his best movie. There's so many, you know, and a lot of Dylan's editing is trusting the audience because you have a lot of close-ups of Daniel Day-Lewis or the other actors whose names escape me right now. They're not saying anything. There's no dialogue, you know, there might be no dialogue, but he's so skillful, again, at interpreting the inner dialogue of a character, and he trusts the audience to know what the character's thinking. If you've got a good actor, you can read their mind, you know, and that's the idea.
Yeah. Exactly.
But also because it takes courage to trust an audience, you know, to ask the audience to, you know, come up to meet you at that level rather than panic and make everything obvious. I mean, I'm sure as soon as I get off this podcast, I'll be flooded with ideas about what the most incredible editing. I really liked The Biggest Splash by Luca Guadagnino. I thought the editing on that was incredible. I guess it's interesting when I'm thinking about these films, they're all quite edity films. You know, there's a lot of like very obvious editing going on. You know, it's not obvious. I mean, intentional editing that calls attention to itself. And really, my style is the opposite of that generally. Oh, Zola was a brilliantly edited film. Years ago, Joy McMillan edited that. She was the editor of Moonlight.
Ah, okay, amazing. Okay, those are great five choices, actually.
Well, it's really nice to meet you.
It was lovely to meet you as well. And thank you so much for answering all my questions.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Real Girls Club. I really enjoyed chatting with Louise. Hearing how she went from journalism to editing some of the most striking films in recent years was fascinating. It's also an important reminder that creative careers rarely follow a straight line. If you like this episode, feel free to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with a friend. And for more stories from the amazing women, from the amazing women shaping cinema, you can follow us on Instagram @Real Girls Club. I'll see you in the next one. Thank you.